The Viridian Nutrition range of 200-plus award-winning products includes vitamins, minerals, herbs, nutritional oils, specialty supplements, tinctures, and balms, all formulated to be healthful, efficacious, and pure. By choosing our Viridian Nutrition range, you are one step closer to your goal of 100% wellness. Ethical vitamins with an organic heart. Available at all Browns outlets. Browns and you.
Welcome to the She Word. Conversations that women rarely have, but really should. I'm your host, Trudy Kerr. Now, here at The She Word, we know that not every show is for every woman. Some topics are more specific to a smaller demographic of the She Word community, and that's perfectly cool. Because for those women, being seen and holding the conversation is truly empowering. Just over a year ago, we produced a mini-series titled Living with a Narcissist, It's Not About You. To our huge surprise, this mini-series racked up over 30,000 views and listens. And still to this day, women bring up this in conversation and thank us for breaking down such an important topic with this mini-series. Well, a few weeks ago, I was sitting with a friend over a coffee, and she told me, Trudy, I've just listened to a podcast that talks about the lasting effects that a narcissistic mother can have on daughters, and that the daughters of such mothers can have so much empathy that they often steer away from having their own children to avoid the possibility of doing the same to any child that they haven't even had yet. The two of us sat in silence, looking at each other with a lump in our throat, and I replied, I have to listen to this. Now, shortly after this first conversation, two other ladies opened up about the long-lasting impact and damage that a narcissist had caused in their lives, and that was it. We've previously talked about how to identify narcissistic behavior, whether the narcissist is born or made, how to deal with a narcissist, and so many other conversations. But I started researching the effects that a narcissist can have on an individual, particularly if you're a child, and how we can identify this in ourselves and then start navigating a healing. So here to help me dive into this show are three women who know something about this topic. Ladies, thank you so much for being here. Again, well, actually, Caroline Vassallo, this is your first rodeo.
Exactly.
First rodeo with the She Word.
Exactly.
Well, listen, I'd like to thank you for being here. You are a Gestalt psychotherapist. Is that a Gestalt? I always worry about that.
Yes,
okay, I got
that
right.
Perfect.
And you have a special interest in narcissism, but also childhood trauma, which makes you perfect for this show. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about yourself in just a second. Claire Borge.
Hi.
Psychotherapist and co-founder at Indigo Psychology Services, working with adults on issues related to trauma, anxiety, self-esteem, bereavement, depression, relationships, burnout, and other difficulties. Is this your third trip here?
I think it's my fourth or fifth.
Oh my word. Wow. I mean, it's so cool to have you back, but you were part of that epic series, that mini series that we had relating to narcissists. And I don't know about you, but I was blown away by the response.
For sure.
I was absolutely
blown away.
It was
very impactful.
Yeah. And for anybody who's dealing with that as an issue, and I'll talk about it a little bit later on, but you look underneath this show, you'll find the links to that series because we'll be referencing it during the course of this show. So good to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you for more details in a second. Oh, Roberta Ferrugia de Bono, Dr. Roberta, Miss Roberta.
I'm more like it.
Because since we last had you on the show, you've become a bit of a celeb.
Indeed.
You are a clinical psychologist, family therapist, and a frequent friend of the show. You were also involved in that narcissist series. I'm going to stick with you. How many times have you been on the show?
I lost count now. Really, I was trying to think. Probably four or five times as well. I was on the first season for two times and then I lost count. Really.
Yeah, you've been here quite a few times.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Trudy.
It's always a pleasure to have you here. But I'm going to stick with you for a second because I just said that you've become a bit of a celebrity psychologist. You've been involved in Big Brother.
Yes, I was the psychologist who was on the show. So my role was to be on the show and discuss all the dynamics there. And being a systemic practitioner also, as well as a psychologist, I could see a lot of dynamics happening that I could talk about and discuss and kind of support people to understand more about what was happening, about how the group developed, about the ways the, you know, the dynamics were happening. I love reality shows. So for me, it was always on my bucket list to be part of Big Brother. So, you know, when eventually, once it started, they called me, I said, yes, I'll be there.
You see that face? Yes, I'll be there. Claire, you've been on the show before, but for anybody who hasn't seen you on the show before, did I miss out any details?
No, I don't think so. I think you've pretty much summed it up. Actually, you've said a lot of things. I'm like, yes, okay. That, this and that. So yes, I think it's brilliant. Enough. But thank you for having me again.
I can't thank you enough for being back on the show, both of you ladies, because this is such an important topic. And only recently did I realize how impactful that series has been. But Caroline, this is your first rodeo, and yes, I must have missed out things about you. So tell me a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. So I wasn't always particularly into psychotherapy. So if I go back to the university, I studied BA in philosophy and psychology. My aim was to further my studies actually in philosophy and to merge it a bit with art, because I was always into art, you know, using art to express myself, using also, I use art actually nowadays with clients to help them express their emotions.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Oh, well, listen, I'm going to be like tracking you down online and stalking you to find out more about that.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for being here. I'm so glad that you came and joined us.
Thank you for the invite.
You are so, so welcome. Life is never plain sailing, but your period is one challenge that shouldn't ever stop you or stand in your way. Tampax is the number one combination for comfort, protection, and discretion. Tampax tampons are independently tested so you can be certain that there's no harmful substances present. Tampax adapts to your unique body shape to provide you protection even when you're living life to the full, because nothing should stop you. Period. Now, I want to kick off by, first of all, reflecting back on something that we've said on the show before, and that is that narcissistic personality disorder, NPD, is estimated to affect up to 6.7% of the general population. However, a person can display a large percentage of narcissistic traits without being diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. And all of this can be responsible for all of us can be responsible for displaying one or more of the 12 classic narcissistic traits, which then leads me to this question. We banter this term around a lot.
Yes,
it's very, very popular. I got to be honest with you, it's not something I'd ever heard until about 10 years ago, but now we hear it a lot. Mm-hmm. But if up to 6.7% of the population have got this NPD, we've all at some point been in contact with a narcissist or someone with narcissistic personality disorder, or maybe we even display narcissistic qualities ourselves. So what I want to kick off with is, can we just explain what is narcissism, what is narcissistic personality disorder, and what are the... What are we talking about today?
I think we have to be very careful in the way we use the term narcissism, because nowadays everybody kind of is a narcissist, which is not true at all. Okay. So sometimes, you know, when there are people who are a bit, full of themselves or a bit less empathic than one would expect, immediately people would kind of, you know, throw that label at the person, especially if he's a male. And the person would be labeled as narcissist. When in actual fact, you know, as you said, there are 12, signs and symptoms to be able to diagnose someone who has narcissistic personality disorder. So I think it's very important that we kind of make a distinction between traits, you know, and the actual disorder. So I believe that most of us would have some trait or another. We have characters, okay? So it's very important that we understand that a person who perhaps lacks a bit of empathy is not a narcissist. You know, there needs to be a configuration of things that come together for a person to be diagnosed with a narcissistic personality disorder. And this is the key word here is diagnosed. Okay, nobody can actually diagnose a narcissistic personality disorder unless they're trained to diagnose people with narcissistic personality disorder. And that, I think, is a crucial thing. You know, you can't just fire away diagnosis, any kind of diagnosis, not just this one. People, you know, I don't know if a person has a bit of highs and lows, then they're bipolar. Or then why do we go down that road when we're not trained to diagnose people?
Well, this is really...
It's a pet peeve for me, you know. I come out strongly about this because I worry. You know, I worry when, especially on social media, people start throwing out these labels without them understanding really what they're talking about. You know, and that can be very dangerous. Because if someone thinks I'm a narcissistic personality disorder person, you're going to react to me as if I have that disorder, when in fact I might not have that disorder, because who are you to decide? You know? So... it's problematic, because that will then be a label that I'm going to carry that is going to inform the people around me, because they come to know from you, for example, that I have that disorder, and they're going to react differently towards me. And then, yes, I might get offended, and then I might get sensitive, but it's not because I have a disorder.
It could be very damaging.
It can be very, very damaging. So as much as we're going to be talking about, you know, living with someone, and especially if a parent is narcissistic, it can be damaging. There's also the other side of the coin that I really need to stress at the start, and then we can talk about other stuff, you know? So for a person to be labeled as having narcissistic personality disorder, it needs to be done from a professional who is trained to diagnose. Nobody can do that unless they're trained. And I think I've said what I had to say about it.
Wow. Roberta's kicks off the show on fire. But we have had this conversation before, and I think we also highlighted, I mean, how many of the 12, and I have them in front of me, and we'll run through them in a second, but how many of the 12?
I think six or seven.
Of the 12 traits have to be present in a person for them to have a diagnosis.
It's not one. That's it. It's not one trait. You know, there has to be a constellation of traits, you know, for a person to come up with that diagnosis.
But I want to just touch on that, because there is also, as you were talking, I thought to myself, for someone to be diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, they would have to be seen, as you rightly said, by a professional. It's unlikely that a narcissist is going to volunteer to go to therapy where they can be diagnosed. So we also have this sort of in-between no man's land where there are people that I would say I have looked at and gone, wow, because I've had first-hand experience and I've looked at the list and said, okay, I can tick that. I absolutely know from my own personal experience.
Yes. And I think sometimes people go to therapy not because they are concerned about their own actions and behavior. So they might go to therapy because they're concerned with other people's behavior. So sometimes clients would kind of complain about colleagues and relatives and partners. And then maybe that could lead a person to getting a diagnosis if it's needed, or, you know, if it's supportive to the process. And even when we are trained to diagnose, we're still very careful, so we don't just label someone with a personality disorder, because we know the implications. So we need to have a context, we need to get to know the person, and as Roberta said, obviously the professional needs to be properly trained, because obviously then what do you do with that diagnosis? It can inform therapy, yes, you know, people can get help, but you need to make sure that the diagnosis is going to support the process and not to damage the person or the people who are close to the person.
And you need to meet the person. The one of the most unethical things that can happen is that someone is given a diagnosis or gives a diagnosis without actually meeting with the person. So as you said, yes, some people would come for therapy and would tell me, you know, because my husband is this and this, or my mother is this and this, do you think she's narcissistic? I always tell them, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. You know, because I need to be meeting with that person. What you're describing mm-hmm. is a very difficult experience. And I can understand and I can empathize how tough it was for you. But I cannot say your mother is has narcissistic personality disorder or your husband is a narcissist. I will never, ever say that without actually meeting the person. You know, because ethically, I cannot diagnose someone without actually seeing him or her, without, as you said, going through an interview schedule, you know, getting all the context, getting a history. There's a process that needs to happen in diagnosis, you know?
For the sake of this show, I think it's also quite important because we're going to be talking about parents and children. We're going to be talking about people that are in relationships and so on. But I think for the sake of this show, I think it's worth just saying, if you want to find out more about that, go back to the miniseries. Mm-hmm. The link is beneath here and you'll be able to see the miniseries and find out more information about that. But I'm going to list the traits that are these 12 traits. Yes. So that if someone's listening to the show and they're thinking to themselves, okay, this is ticking boxes. At least there's some awareness, even yes. if there's not of a diagnosis.
Exactly. Yeah. An awareness of the experience, because this experience is very real. I'm not saying it's not real, you know, but we need to be talking about the experience yes. more than anything.
So in a nutshell, how do you know that you're dealing with a narcissist in your life? A parent, a sibling, a work colleague, partner or friend? Well, here are these 12 traits. A gross sense of entitlement, need for admiration or attention, lack of empathy, fragile self-esteem, feelings of arrogance and superiority, manipulative and exploitative behavior, envy and belief in others, envy, obsession with power and success, lack of boundaries, emotional volatility, fear of loss or rejection, and relationship issues. And that's just like in a broad overview of the 12 traits of narcissism. So we're going to put it in the context that that's what we've identified. Mm-hmm. And I want to start looking at, in this conversation, we're going to address the impact mm-hmm. of narcissists and narcissism on their victims. And I'm going to use yes. the word victims because I believe that they are, because I want to then look at how we can start a healing journey. And I want to look also a little bit later on more specifically on the impact of children, which is, of course, something for you there, Caroline. But because a classic trait of a narcissist is to make a person feel crazy and to second guess them all the time mm-hmm. and believe that everything that goes wrong is their fault. What are the classic symptoms it's a huge question, of a victim of a narcissist? And why is the impact so devastating? Whether it's a partner, whether it's a friend, yeah. whether it's a parent, What are we seeing in this? What are we seeing as the symptoms in the victims?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that worries me the most would be that if you are the daughter or the son of someone who is a narcissistic parent, because a narcissistic parent would have a very huge need to feel important and a very huge lack of empathy, that person would be very unseen. So it's all about fulfilling the needs of the narcissistic parent. So the child would be trained to actually always fulfill the needs of the parent. So the needs of the child are never seen. Mm-hmm. And this feeling of not being seen is a very, very painful experience. So I have met, yes, you know, people in therapy who I have felt were never seen. You know, who are not seen by their parents, who were in relationship with parents who were always trying to belittle them, trying to be more powerful than them when they're still a child, you know, trying to live off their successes, you know, but always being very critical of them at the same time. So I think the main experience that these people talk about is the feeling of being unseen, mm-hmm. you know, that your needs are never seen, that yes. you have to always play mm-hmm. up to the needs of mm-hmm. the parent.
And that's something that I can relate to what Roberta was saying, I think that most of the children who are victims of these parents who are diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder exhibit a lot of shame. So besides the belittling, besides the not being good enough for the parent, there is the element of shame that enables sort of the child or the individual to sort of crawl back into the womb almost. So he creates this sort of a shell to protect himself or herself from the world.
Mm-hmm. But are we expecting... Let's take it out, because we're going to talk about children in just a second. Let's take it out of the context of children just for a moment and look at a kind of on a larger scale. But anybody who's had an experience with a narcissist, I believe, having had an experience myself, has a lot of self-doubt.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Definitely.
Tell me what the other symptoms are that you're going to see most likely.
Well, we tend to see narcissistic parents who kind of look at their children as though they're an extension of themselves. So they don't really allow their children to individuate. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem because obviously there's a lot of projection there coming from the parents onto the children, which is something that grows with them. You know, they take on in their adult life then. So if you're never good enough for your parents or you have to live your life through the needs of your parents, then there's an issue with identity as well. And how can you fulfill someone's needs all the time, especially when you're a child? You're still trying to learn about yourself, about others, like, you know, we're still learning about relationships. So that's a lot of pressure that children pick up, because as a child I will either need to take care of my parents if maybe they're not consistent or they're unwell, or else I need to perform, I need to be good, I need to make them feel proud. Otherwise, I'm not going to be loved. I might be rejected, punished, shamed if I'm not fulfilling their wishes, their dreams. They need to show me off. You know, because obviously we know that that is a trait of narcissism, wanting to, you know, feel better than everyone else. So with parents having this issue, they would want their kids to be better than other kids as well.
Well, you see, it's interesting because you've just each of you said about the effects of a narcissistic parent on children from a bit of a different angle. Mm-hmm. And growing up with a narcissistic parent can generate one of a variety of roles, and the child has a role to play. So it might be that the child is a golden child, scapegoat, help a child, invisible, like you said, or lost child, savior or fixer. And children in families with narcissists are suffering tremendous abuse at these early wounds and that shape relationships and so on and so forth. And I think that's where I'm coming to, because I'm wondering if somebody's listening to the show thinking, okay, so maybe I had a narcissistic parent, but I don't know how that's affected me now. Mm-hmm. I mean, those roles are a range of roles and they have all different effects. So I'm just going to ask, I mean, just to throw on the table, the kind of... And again, to caveat this by saying, just because you might be a bit insecure doesn't mean to say that you had a narcissistic parent. But we've run through those traits. And so if somebody is hearing this and saying, okay, I had a narcissistic parent because they ticked 10 of those, then what are we looking at, whether it be a scapegoat or a golden child? I mean, I'm guessing the pressures are different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think most of it relates to finding identity. So as Claire was saying, usually parents try to sort of impose the identity on to the child. So if I am willing to explore my identity outside of what my parents told me, I am seen as the scapegoat. I am seen as the person who is disrespecting authority, my parents, you know. So then there's a difference as well between being the savior. Because in a way, being a savior to the world creates also a sense of trying to save the inner child that was never saved.
Mm-hmm. So give me practical implications for that, because you mentioned that. You talked about a scapegoat, and if they're looking for an identity outside of what... How would they be looking for an identity? What's an example of a scapegoat child looking to validate themselves and being invalidated.
So, practical example, maybe let's take the subject of tattoos. If my parents do not like the aspect of having tattoos, if they see it as something, I don't know, dirty, something that I'm mentioning ideas that Maltese and in the past they usually used to believe. If I experiment with something that my parents do not agree with, I am seen as oppositional to them.
Okay.
So if I am willing to, I don't know, maybe pierce my ears, that is something that will create an argument. And when I'm saying an argument, not just a simple argument, you know, it's a bigger argument that might also lead the child, the individual, to sort of be disowned from this, his own family.
Yes. Just for something yes. like
exactly.
that. Most often these people are people pleasers. Okay, so they would do everything in their power because they know what rage is all about if they displease someone, to be people pleasers. So they won't be assertive at all because also of a lack of self-esteem. Because if your parent is always trying to put you down so that the parent is kind of more seen in a better light, then your self-esteem is going to be chipped. It won't even develop to a certain extent. But then they would also be people pleasers because they know, they have learned that they need to please the people around them to get the love that they need. Yes. You know, because this is it. The love is very unconditional. It's very conditional. Whereas parents need to give unconditional love. So whatever you do, I will still love you. These kind of parents would give very conditional love. I will only love you if you do the right thing, if you do as I say. And if that doesn't happen, if you put a tattoo on or whatever, even simple things like not getting a very good grade in your exams, then they will feel the full force of the rage. And there's what is called as narcissistic rage, okay? That, you know, it's a very, very violent kind of rage, you know? A rage that makes you feel like you're really the shittiest person in the world, you know? And it will be thrown at you. Imagine you're a three-year-old, a four-year-old who's just, you know, being a bit naughty, you know, and you're out with friends and you're just a little bit naughty. You're just a four-year-old. You're not naughty. You're full of energy, but you're not behaving as you should be behaving, you know, and this full, you know, rage comes onto you, you know, it's going to be devastating. Yes. So next time round, you are going to be pleasing your parents 100%, you know, and the next time round, and then you become an adult who has to please, who cannot say no, who is very unassertive. And that is very worrying, you know?
Can I just stick with that for a second?
Yes.
Because you mentioned about this people-pleasing and wanting to please a parent. But we know that a narcissist is impossible to please.
Of course.
And that a child can, on a Monday, lay the table and everything is perfect and everything is laid out, and that narcissistic parent will be like, oh, well done, thank you very much indeed. And on the Wednesday, they do exactly the same, and it's suddenly not okay. And I think that is, you're talking about being people pleaser. I mean, that stretching to people please when the goalposts keep moving,
it's moving,
that must lead to serious psychological damage, does it not?
For sure, and it creates a lot of anxiety. And in fact, we notice that children start becoming very hypervigilant as well, very aware of their surroundings, always waiting for the last shoe to drop. So it can create mental health difficulties then. And I think, you know, we all want to be loved for who we are, even when we're not doing our best, especially when we're not feeling our best, doing our best. But if I learn that I can only be loved if it's transactional, you know, if I do something that you want me to do, then obviously my idea of love is going to be very skewed. And as you said, you know, the goalpost changes because there is inconsistency, instability. With narcissistic parents, there's a fragile sense of self. So if the parents don't know who they are, what they want, or they do on some days, but not on other days. Then obviously it's very hard to understand and to comprehend what's going on. I mean, no one is a mind reader, and even as adults, we cannot read other people's minds, let alone as children. You know, as children, our brains are still developing as well. And it's exhausting to try to keep up with all the inconsistencies.
Why is that a narcissistic trait? Why are narcissists so intentionally inconsistent?
I think you have to look at the way a narcissist would develop. So possibly... at least that is my theory. It's based on other theories, but what I believe is that usually in the very early years of a child's life, if there is some form of damage that happens to the relationship with the loved one, there are different ways in which the child would interpret it. Now, a person who eventually develops into a narcissistic person would think that, you know, someone has slighted him or her, so possibly the someone would be the mother of the father, but that person would think that they did it because they could not understand how special they are. So they develop the sense of, I am very special, and the people around me cannot understand my specialness, and this is why they did what they did. Mm-hmm. And that rage that comes from being slighted becomes a problem for them. And this is what they like. This is what they developed, and this sense that they are perfect, you know, and everyone else is not perfect. But underneath that perfection, there is a lot of self-doubt, a lot of a very low self-esteem. So they feel they're nothing. But to be able to defend themselves against the slight they received as very young kids, they would develop this sense that I am invisible, I'm powerful. Mm-hmm. And everybody needs to appreciate this. And also, you know, whoever does not appreciate this, then they're not good enough, mm-hmm. you know. And this continues. And then when they become parents... when a child does not see their specialness, or when a child challenges their specialness, that is where again there would be this narcissistic rage onto them. Mm-hmm. So this is what happens. You know, this is how a narcissistic personality is formed. It's always the child. It's the childhood years that form.
Mm-hmm. Because you know, you've just said
character.
Two things that I'm going to come back on that, because Claire and I believe it was us that sat down and with the conversation, are narcissists made or born?
Yes.
And the answer to that is that they're made. Mm-hmm. But as you just rightly pointed out there, children are nothing if not painfully truthful.
Yeah.
And because young children haven't developed the ability to mask and hide. And they will tell you, if, as you said, they'll say, Mummy, you know, that's not good. Mm-hmm. And Mummy, that doesn't look good. Or Daddy, that's not right. Mm-hmm. And before they've learned to protect themselves, there's a lot of truth coming out there, mm-hmm. which, of course, as you've said, is what a narcissist is going to have problems with. And therefore, to move the goalpost throws a narcissist's victim off kilter. And that's what they want to do all the time, isn't it? Have somebody off kilter so that they can never get on top of the game. Am I right?
Yes. They manipulate to keep feeling good about themselves. There's this really strong need to feel very special, because deep down inside they don't. But then they would manipulate things. And this is why there's gaslighting. This is why they would not accept that there's something, you know, that they've
done. Gaslighting, I'm going to stop you, because if we use the term gaslighting, I said to myself before we sat down, if somebody says gaslighting, we need to
explain it,
because I think this is something else that is just used.
It's so often understood sometimes,
I don't know. Shall I go? Will you like
to go? I've got a nodding Claire there. Claire's let's go.
Because once again, it's also a term that we hear a lot from people. But generally, when we speak of gaslighting, we're talking about someone who's experiencing a lot of doubt about what they're doing, what they're saying. Their reality is challenged, basically. So the person who's manipulative would be trying to remain in control and try to alter the other person's, or the victim's, let's say, reality. Because obviously it would suit the person who is manipulating the dynamic, basically.
So I just, for the sake of of understanding what gaslighting is, I'm going to ask you ladies to, I'm going to ask you to role play. I'm not going to ask Roberta to do that, because last time I did that with Roberta, I scared the pants off her. So let's go with a kind of mother-daughter scenario. Caroline, are you happy to be the little girl?
Yeah.
That means, unfortunately, Claire, we're going to role play you as the narcissistic mother. Okay. Is that okay for a minute?
For educational purposes.
Only, absolutely. So, Caroline, you've just come back from school. You've got a nice new pair of tights on. You've fallen over at school and you've scraped your knee. So you're going to tell your mum that.
Okay. Mom, I'm so sorry. I scraped my knee. I was playing in the playground. I know that they're new. I'm sorry.
You know how much I do for you? You know how much I work so that I can have enough money to buy you clothes, and I'm always trying my best to make sure that you look decent. And this isn't the first time. I know it isn't the first time. Yes. You should be more careful.
But I was playing. Other people were playing as well. Other students
but
were playing.
But what happened to the other students, to your peers? Did they also tear?
Not all of them. Some of them.
Mm-hmm. But some of them who?
Well, my friend Julia, she fell.
And is it the first time for her as well?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. That's actually quite frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, because you're basically telling this mm-hmm. small child who's fallen over and ripped her tights innocently that you've made it all about you.
Mm-hmm.
You've made it about all the sacrifices that you've... Oh, I have to say, that was incredibly convincing. And are you okay?
Yes.
I'm worried about Caroline.
Caroline.
Now I'm feeling how Roberta felt. When I, but that is, so that would be gaslighting. That would be taking a reality of, and not even asking Caroline how her knee is.
Exactly. Yes. That's the lack of empathy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The comparison as well. I mean, it might not look exactly like this. Obviously, we're role playing. But yes, there is the comparison, the shame, feeling like, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself or guilty for hurting your mother or for not sort of appreciating the fact that then she's going to have to go out and buy you another pair of tights. So... Yes.
It's all about the narcissist, the and it's obviously not about the victim.
Obviously.
Wow.
And gaslighting would also be something like telling her, are you sure you really fell?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, because I saw you playing with your tights. Are you sure you really fell?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
You must have torn your tights because you are playing with them.
Yeah.
So she's actually...
Inflicted out.
So she innocently fell. And she's putting the doubts on her, you know, that whether she fell or not, and whether she was purposely, you know, playing with her tights to tear them or something like that.
Yes.
You know, so the distortion of the reality is even bigger.
Yes, I'm thinking something a parent would say, you do this on purpose to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
So that would also be something that I would add to
exactly.
that.
Well, I want to add another element to this, and of course that this is an experience that you've just very beautifully, and thank you very much, illustrated.
Not sure we're very great actors, to be honest.
But I think the message came across
I think the message came across very clearly, because I was sitting here quite nervous and uncomfortable, and I think Roberta was as well, let alone Caroline.
Out of milk, bread's gone, and the kids are hungry? Don't stress. There's a Dave's just around the corner. Open 24/7. Or skip the trip. Just tap the Dave's app. Tap, tap, tie-up. They'll deliver straight to your door. No minimum order, speedy delivery, and fresh fruit packed with care. Dave's cares about you.
But part of the problem, therefore, of being a child of a narcissistic parent, and I want to look at the impact of this, is that narcissistic, let's take the example of a narcissistic mother, for instance. They, or father, it doesn't really matter, but they can be very upheld great positions in society. Yes. Mm-hmm. They can be very impressive at dinner parties, because this is, we know, is part of the point of a narcissist. Is they can be extremely charming as well.
Mm-hmm.
But they can be showing the world their good side. They can have very respected roles. and maybe a parent is on the parent council or the PTA at school, mm-hmm. and people are talking about how wonderful your mum is. Isn't your mum lovely? And, but then you get behind closed doors.
Of mm-hmm. course.
Behind closed doors and poor Caroline scraped her knees on and ripped her tights.
Exactly.
So how do we rationalise this? How does this affect a child as they grow into adulthood? What are the long-term implications of this? And how do we make sense of this external reality versus the internal reality?
Mm-hmm. Big I think questions. It's an issue of trust. Yes. How can you trust, you know, your reality? And this issue then goes into also in relationships, because then you start saying to yourself, how can I trust my partner when he tells me he loves me? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be real? You know, can I actually trust my partner when he says something which is nice, which is loving, which is caring? You know, you're always waiting for that moment when everything is going to turn really black and, you know, your partner is going to go and accuse you of something or something like that. That's what you're trained. This is what you know. As you said, the hypervigilance, you know, there'll be this sense of, you know, I have to be on edge all the time because I know something bad is going to happen. I cannot trust my reality. I cannot trust my feelings. I cannot trust that the person who's saying that he loves me or she loves me is real. You know, so it becomes very problematic for them to be in relationship with friends and then eventually with partners. It becomes very difficult.
And I'm not going to trust the other person to hold me as well. And I'm not going to trust that the other person will be there for me on my bad days, when I'm a bit grumpy perhaps, or when I'm a bit sad or anxious. I might feel like I have to hide that, because if my partner sees that, they won't like it and they won't love me anymore. So it's very difficult to be yourself in a relationship when you've experienced all that growing up, because you're afraid of showing your true self.
Would it be true to say then that the child of a narcissistic parent is probably going to look for a lot of reassurance mm-hmm. and may even ask a lot, are you sure you love mm-hmm. me? Do you love yes. me? Do you love me? Do you still love
it
me?
It can go both ways. Exactly. So you can have someone who would need that reassurance, or else someone who is not able to ask for help mm-hmm. or someone who's going to be avoidant, to move away, to hide.
Very Depends. Self-reliant. You can be very mm-hmm. self-reliant because you've learned that you are not going to get the help that you need. So you have to depend on yourself. And they would be very, very self-reliant. And even in relationships, they would, as I said, they would be very scared of relying on someone, because what they know is that the earlier, you know, relationships were ones in which they could not rely on that person. Mm. So I think they would have, it can go both ways. Yes. It can really go both ways. Either you'd have someone who's constantly needing reassurance, but to a certain extent, I would rather go for the other side, where the person would be very self-reliant, because they don't know what reassurance looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, they might be wanting reassurance deep down, but they would be very scared of getting it, because they would know that eventually, you know, they're going to get, you know, whacked again, you know, with rage. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I think something else with regards to relationships, you see a lot of people who have never experienced safety in their life, never experienced connection as well, you know, choosing different partners all the time, being with different partners to experience that sort of validation. Mm-hmm. So when you ask someone, what do you look for in a relationship? What does a relationship mean? They don't know, because they have never had a relationship with their primary caregiver. So they're in their adulthood, they're still testing what a relationship is or should be for mm-hmm. them.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, these implications are massive. I mean, we talked about looking for reassurance because the person who was the primary caregiver, as you said, just didn't show up. And you just mentioned other traits being self-reliant. Poor self-care mm-hmm. is, when I looked into the research, mm-hmm. poor self-care is also a trait mm-hmm. of a victim of childhood narcissism and not feeling good enough. How on earth do we start to deal with this? How do we look at retraining the brain and retraining the neurological pathways in the brain that have taken so long to develop, but have developed mm-hmm. from such an early age. How on earth do we, as the children of narcissists, develop our identity outside of what our parents have told us?
We have to reparent ourselves. So, yes, it's a term we use in therapy, because if we haven't been parented properly, if we haven't been loved properly, we need to learn how to love ourselves now, because obviously, I mean, if I didn't get support, if I didn't get reassurance, I need to give that to myself. You know, as an adult, you go through so many things in life and you can't always rely on others. And as Roberta was saying, sometimes you wouldn't even want to rely on others. So we work on reparenting, sort of giving yourself what you wanted your parents to give you. What was missing? Maybe boundaries, learning how to take care of yourself, voicing your needs. Actually having a voice. We also talk about safety, sort of regulating our nervous system as well, because as you said, it affects us on a neurological level. So there's a lot of work that can be done, and it is possible. You know, we do talk about moving on from an insecure attachment style as well to this acquired, gained, secure attachment style as well. So then if we have healthy relationships with others, we can learn that not everyone is going to treat us the way our parents mm-hmm. used to treat us. But obviously allowing yourself to meet these people and to be in a relationship with them might take a lot of work.
I'm going to come back to this term.
Reparenting.
I'm going to come back to this in a second, because this is just phenomenal. I've never heard this. Mm-hmm. It also made me incredibly sad. Mm-hmm. But before we dive into that, you also mentioned something there about the relationships. Does a child of a narcissistic parent have a tendency, you mentioned about different mm-hmm. kinds of relationships, to seek out relationships with other narcissists? Because I've seen this, I've researched and I've heard
this. Is what
this.
You know. Mm-hmm. So initially, especially, I think that is what you would look for, because that is what you know. So if you if your self-esteem is really low, you don't know you deserve any better. And that is what, you know, the first person that comes along, possibly because, as we know, narcissists can be very charming at the beginning.
I was going to say, because that's not, you know, you mean it, meet a narcissist.
I
had a long-term relationship with a narcissist.
They would make you feel very special.
Charming.
Exactly. They would make you feel very special, very loved, you know, the love bombing that happens at first. Mm-hmm. So if you're very deprived, you'll fall for it immediately, you know. And then possibly you would stay in such a relationship because that is what you know. So then you are also already trained to be in a relationship with a narcissist because of your own parenting. So you know what you need to be doing. You need to be quiet. You need to not show what you need. You need to not challenge the person. So you know, you have the training. And you end up in a relationship with a narcissist, unfortunately. You can really end up in a relationship with a narcissist.
Rachel Williams said something on the show, the very first show that we did about domestic violence. And there's a lot of this that has a crossover between the two topics. Yeah. And she said that she didn't have the equipment to identify her abuser because she was from an abusive situation. Exactly. Yeah. So she didn't have the navigation to be able to identify that.
Your nervous system knows it already. Mm-hmm. It has experienced it already. So, you know, sometimes people talk about butterflies and excitement and in the beginning, but sometimes that means that our nervous system is dysregulated. So if we're not feeling calm, safe, I'm not saying that it's always like this, right? But sometimes for people having this background, they might associate that with love because that's what their nervous system knows. And then when they have a healthy kind of love, it's boring because their nervous system is not in fight or flight mm-hmm. mode, you know?
Okay.
That's what they know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to dive a little bit further into this because this is so profound. I've heard this over and over again in tiny little bits on this show, on the She Word and other podcasts, that fight or flight is dysregulated so that a victim, a childhood victim of narcissism is always in a fight or flight mm-hmm. system. And therefore, somebody who comes along with reassurance and calmness will seem boring.
Yes.
Exactly. Explain that to me, because that very doesn't unfamiliar. Make sense.
It's very unfamiliar. And I'm not going to feel excited. I'm not going to feel on edge, because if the person is being consistent with me and I don't know what that experience is like, I'm going to get bored easily. We know that when someone is inconsistent, it's also very addictive as well. I mean, this is like, gambling and other addictions, really. Sometimes there are highs, sometimes there are lows. And that reinforcement, that sort of inconsistent, let's say, reinforcement traps us. When it's consistent and we know what to expect, then, you know, it's not as exciting and as thrilling. Like, if you know that you're going to a vending machine and every time you're going to insert coins, you're going to get something. I mean, maybe, you know, it will make you feel good for a couple of seconds and that's that, you know. But if you're at a casino or wherever and there's a slot machine, you win some, you lose some, and that's exciting, you know. So we kind of see that in relationships as well, with people who are not being consistent, that can be very exciting, but it can also be very dangerous, very exhausting as well. So yes, consistency mm-hmm. is sometimes associated with boredom mm-hmm. and then wanting to move on to something else.
See, Sephora said it very clearly again on the domestic violence show, and I'd recommend anyone to go back and see it, because there's a lot of crossover here. Mm-hmm. Yes. She talks about the fact that she lived for that moment of approval, because it was given so infrequently.
Exactly.
Yes. That love bombing was so infrequent that she lives for it. She lives for that makeup moment when you've had a row and that person comes and says, which we know is so true in narcissists, and says,
hey, you're special.
You're mm-hmm. special. Let's make up. Mm-hmm. And lives for that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's heartbreaking, though, isn't it?
Because that's very reinforcing, as she's saying. That is very reinforcing. That's what keeps you there. That's mm-hmm. what keeps you hooked in that relationship. That moment when someone's going to tell you you're special. Because, again, if you have never heard this even as a child, you know, or you're only special because you made me special, you know, so it's all about me, then obviously you really want to hear mm-hmm. that. And the one time you hear it, it will keep you hooked, you know. So initially you're very special, and then something happens, you go a bit out of line and there is a whole drama. But then you say, oh, no, he'll tell me or she'll tell me that I'm special again. And you'll stay there, because it will come at some point, but, you know, in between, there's a lot of times when you're not special at all, you know, but you keep on waiting for that moment. And that little bit that you get reinforces you to stay there, unfortunately.
So I want to come back to this idea of, was it self-parenting or reparenting?
I think you can use both.
You can either. The reason I say that is because self-parenting to me sounds so sad mm-hmm. and lonely. Mm-hmm. How do we on earth go about navigating self-parenting or reparenting and going back, and I assume that's rewriting what mm-hmm. we've learned. Mm-hmm.
I think one space where this can happen is in a therapeutic relationship, because in a therapeutic relationship, there's a lot of unconditional positive regard. So when you are working with someone who has never been seen, the fact that you are seeing the pain, that you are acknowledging and witnessing the experience, is a very powerful tool that we have in therapy. And through seeing them, through actually witnessing and acknowledging what they have been through, they would then start themselves acknowledging and witnessing what they have been through. So through that first therapeutic relationship, they start to experience something which they have not experienced before. Eventually, they will introject it. So initially it would be, okay, my therapist is saying I'm good enough. And then slowly, slowly, hopefully, they'll come to a point where they start saying, oh, you know, I'm good enough. Mm-hmm. So it's a very long process.
But doesn't that, I'm asking you as each of you as therapists, does that mm-hmm. not, do you not see rage? Do you not see anger?
Of course.
I mean, you must all, do. All, if all a, the, an adult
Sometimes it's difficult to see and make all, I'm going to use the word make, because sometimes I think that you need to actually work on the individual's emotions that have been stored there and conditioned. So if I am aware that, for example, my mother was a narcissist, and while I was growing up, I experienced this pattern that you're mentioning, I will learn to keep that rage inside me because my mother told me to be nice, to be well-behaved. So for me to actually express my rage in therapy, I need to sort of disobey my mother.
Yeah, but once you realize how you've been conditioned and how you've been how you've been used as a toaster. Yes. And I'm going to make this reference as the toaster again, because for me it was has been the easiest way to understand a relationship that a narcissist has with anybody around them. And it's a very simple explanation. For a narcissist, you might be a toaster. And whilst they want toast, you're the only thing that they want. But the minute that that person doesn't want toast, you have no use to them. And when you discover that, whether it be through an intimate relationship or a parent relationship, that must be agonizing.
Yes, and especially for us women, I would say, I mean, we're used to, you know, patriarchal norms. So we're told to be good, to be polite. If we're assertive, we're labeled as bossy, aggressive, manly, even, you know. So we're told to be good, to care for others, to nurture. So then when we disobey, as Caroline is saying, I think the impact on girls could be different. I mean, for boys, there are other challenges, right? Because then they can't express their emotions and they bottle it up. But I think when it comes to this disobedience, for us women, it's a bigger challenge because we also experience it out there in society. You know, we're told that we have to kind of get in line, sort of. So it's very difficult to find your voice, to actually voice your anger, to allow yourself, to give yourself permission to be angry, because you wouldn't be able to do that anywhere else except in the therapeutic space, because that's a safe space.
So if you have been through this journey and you've identified that has been your path, the really only safe way of navigating and moving into a healthy adult position is through therapy.
I would say therapy is very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. It can be that you meet a good person in your life and you're at a point in your life where you allow yourself to be loved in a good way. And then, yes, you can actually start experiencing good love and start to love yourself through being loved by a good person, you know. So it doesn't have to necessarily be through therapy. But it needs to be a person who can actually tell you, you know, what you've been through is really bad. Mm-hmm. That's really not okay. I mean, this is what we do in therapy, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't be in a relationship with someone who starts to acknowledge, you know, that these things were not okay for you, and so on and so forth. So at that point, you start to question, could it be that perhaps that was not okay? Mm-hmm. And this person is offering me something different. Could it be that this is how it should be? You know, so it can happen in the context of a relationship with someone who is very secure and who can love you really for who you are. I would say it's not so easy to find people like that in real life. You might find it later on because, as we said, there are patterns of behavior that have happened that would not make you stick with someone like that because he might be boring, actually, you know. So I would say therapy is one way in which you can really do this process, where the therapist is going to tell you that was not okay. You know, that's what we do. Initially, we have to do that work. You know, we have to start telling that, you know, our clients, that is abuse or that should not have been like that.
I want to come to that and go a little bit deeper because what really struck me, and one of the reasons that I said we have to sit down and talk about this, is because I had this conversation with a friend who highlighted a journey whereby women who are have grown up, who have been the daughters of a narcissistic mother, can quite often choose not to have children because they project the possibility of them doing that to another child. Now, with all of the transitions and the new kind of norms of society that we face at the moment, it could be that a woman might say to herself, well, I haven't got time for children because mm-hmm. I have a career, or I haven't got time for children because I want to travel. And it could be masking this trauma that mm-hmm. that person has been through. And as I sat and I listened to that, I said to myself, wow, that is really complicated, mm-hmm. but it's also huge because it is then going to affect that person's life so significantly, because we as women have these choices about whether or not we want to have family. We make that choice hopefully with our partner, but there might be some resistance, not because of a career, but because there's an underlying fear that's not been acknowledged. So I as I was sitting there, I was thinking about this, and I was listening to what you were saying. There's a lot of self-awareness if somebody sits there and they say, okay, this is what happened to me in my childhood, and this is where I need to deal with that, and I need to move forward. But I'm also assuming that there's a lot of less obvious characteristics of a daughter. Let's go with a daughter mm-hmm. who has grown up in the family of a narcissist that even perhaps you as therapist mm-hmm. might not come across, because it might not come up in therapy. Mm-hmm. But that, for instance, this one of not choosing, which apparently is quite common.
I actually ask the question sometimes, do you want to have kids? That's a question I often ask.
So this is actually well known and well documented.
Yes. And often the answer would be no. Because I'm afraid I can turn into my mother if, you know, I'm not supported enough or anything like that. So I actually asked that question because, yes, we do know mm-hmm. that people who have been through childhood traumas, whatever they mm-hmm. might be, you know, would be very, in a way, conscious of the fact that they do not want to put their kids through what they have been through mm-hmm. for whatever reason. Sometimes even when parents separate, for example. You know, some people opt not to have kids because they have been through a separation themselves and they would not want their kids to go through that should they separate from their partner. Mm-hmm. You know, and some people actually stay in relationships in a broken marriage because they have come from a broken marriage and they don't want their kids to, because they already have kids, they don't want their kids to go through what they have done. So there's a lot of empathy there that happens. But yes, it's a conversation that can be had, and we do have it.
Yes, for sure. They're afraid of transgenerational trauma as well, you know, the trauma that we pass on from one generation to another. And sometimes, I mean, you'd meet clients and they would tell you, I know that I'm trying to break the cycle, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that. It feels too big, and it is big. And obviously, if there's, you know, an issue with self-esteem as well, they might feel like they're not capable enough to do that. It's a huge burden to carry. So yes, although we understand that there are people who don't want to have children for other reasons, definitely. When it comes to narcissistic parents and parents who have other mental health difficulties as well, sometimes there is the fear that it's passed on, even genetically. Clients ask us, like, is this genetic? Could I pass this on to my children as well? So it's a conversation we have. And even with parents who have children, adults who have children, who can't understand how their parents behaved in the way they did, because, you know, they would tell us, like, I would never be able to do that to my son or to my daughter. How did my mom do that to me? And it's very painful. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they go through the motions, like when their children reach a certain age, which would remind them as parents of the things they would have endured at that age. It's very triggering. Mm-hmm. So then we have to work on the triggers, because otherwise we're going to keep repeating the patterns, and if we're triggered, we're going to project. So there's a lot mm-hmm. of work that's happening.
But isn't
there.
It incredibly heartbreaking that you just said just there, Claire, that a parent is terrified that they would do that again to their child, when in actual fact that self-awareness and that empathy is exactly the reason they won't do it. Surely. Yeah. Am I right?
Exactly. Mm. Yes. The first step towards it is actually having someone validating your awareness. So the fact that I am accepting that I went through all this, the fact that you have an individual who is not justifying what the individual went through, actually is the first step towards achieving a healthy lifestyle, because unfortunately a lot of individuals still find excuses for their for the behavior of their parents. Mm-hmm. So not everyone finds it easy or is angered when they know actually that their parents are narcissists.
Or I'm going to stick with that.
Yeah.
Because in a second, I'm going to ask you, each of you, mm-hmm. to give some heads up mm-hmm. to what somebody who's listening to this show and saying, okay, maybe I should need to deal with this in my life, to give some advice and some direction. But I want to stick with something that you just said there, because we've discussed the idea that a child of a narcissist or a partner of a narcissist, let's go with that, or a friend of a narcissist or a work colleague of a narcissist, anybody who's involved in that, is going and is of narcissist's victim. Because I want to be clear about this. Not everybody who comes in contact with a narcissist is a narcissist's victim. Yeah. There are certain parameters that mean that a narcissist will choose somebody mm-hmm. to be mm-hmm. their feed, mm-hmm. their supply. Mm-hmm. And that supply will... pointing at you, Caroline. But that supply is as good as they need it. But that a narcissist will always identify mm-hmm. the supply, which yeah. is where yes. the scapegoat comes in. And
the most vulnerable one, the mm-hmm. person with the exactly. lowest self-esteem, yeah. the person who really needs... validation. So initially, that's all they get. Yes. The narcissist would give a lot of validation to hook the person in. Mm-hmm. So they would choose their prey. Let's say they would choose their prey. The sad thing is that a child is not a prey. You know, a child Absolutely. Is a child.
Absolutely. You
know? And that's the sad reality.
That leads me to the question that if then, as you very rightly pointed out, that the supply of the narcissist is going to need validation, probably have low self-esteem, feel invisible, feel unseen. How on earth do you, as that individual, go about feeling worthy of seeking help and validation through therapy or through a relationship, or feeling that you... even that you can acknowledge what happened to you? Because surely the basis of being a supply, as we've just said, means that you turn around and say, mm. I'm not worthy.
This is why these programs are very important, mm-hmm. because people will kind of have an experience, but they can't really put their finger on it. And then they would watch podcasts, they would kind of read about it, and suddenly it starts to... make sense to them, and they would start realizing, this is not just my experience, because that is the problem as well. They would think they are the only one having that experience, when we're saying it's not your own, you're not the only one who's been through this experience. There are other people, there's help out there. So reaching out is very important. But yes, as you said, they need to understand that they need to reach out. And this is why awareness, this is why podcasts like this are super important, mm-hmm. Because that's where, people are going to get the information. They will kind of start ticking the boxes, and hopefully they will reach out for help.
Mm-hmm. And I think also it would also prevent the individual from reaching out when they are rock bottom. Mm-hmm. Because unfortunately, individuals tend to actually reach out for help when they are at this stage. So for the individuals to feel worthy of having a space, someone to listen to me, someone to validate me, they need to realize, they need to be aware before it continues to become bigger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm actually thinking of something right now, because we meet people who come to us because I think they would need some kind of approval to cut ties with their relatives, with their parents, or to learn how to maintain boundaries. So it might be brought to their attention by their partners or relatives or colleagues, or as we're saying, because they would have listened to a podcast, or something that informs them. And then they come to us asking questions like, is it okay if I had to no longer visit my mother? Like, am I going to be a horrible person, a horrible daughter? Mm. Am I going to regret it when my mom passes away? Mm. So sometimes people come to us because of this reason, because I think in close-knit societies, especially, I mean, if I had to take into consideration our context in Malta, it's a taboo issue, you know, it's a taboo topic. Like, wouldn't you want to spend time with your parents? Wouldn't you want to try to build a healthy relationship, a good relationship? But sometimes there is nothing to build on, you know, the foundation is not there, and you can't force your parents to become aware of themselves, to become aware of their actions. So sometimes the only option is to make sure you protect yourself and to maintain boundaries. And that's going to look different for different people. So sometimes, because they come to us for that reason, then we start exploring exactly what has happened, and then they can label their experience, their emotions, and then they might learn about narcissism, for example, or, you know, they might explore it further because of that one concern and that initial question of, what do I do with my parents? Should I be obedient, or should I do what I feel is right for me? Mm-hmm.
I'm just as you were saying that, Claire and Caroline and Roberta, just so many thoughts were going over in my head, and so many thoughts I was thinking of conversations I've had before. And in a moment, I'm going to ask for you to just share as your last thought how and where somebody who's going through this experience can start their recovery journey. Mm-hmm. But before we do that, I want to personally say that absolutely everybody, anybody listening to this show, anybody is worthy of feeling safe on their worst day. And I think this is a conversation I've had over and over again. Mm-hmm. I've asked friends and asked myself, am I safe enough around this person or around these people to let them see me at my worst, when I've had a really shitty day and everything's gone wrong? Am I comfortable enough to come home and say, you know what, that was awful and I've just had a really bad day? Or do I have to come home and be someone else for someone else? And that is where I think we have to draw the line. Mm-hmm. Every single human being has the right to have a bad day and feel loved and worth it, no matter what the circumstances are. And if that's not the experience that you're living right now, definitely, then something is very wrong and you deserve better.
Definitely.
Sorry, slightly emphatic about that.
Yes.
But because you do deserve better.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Everyone deserves better.
Absolutely. And I think that's that you mentioned it before, one of you, and I think that's the real test. Can I be my true self and still be loved? Mm-hmm. Because we can't wear this mask forever. No. At some point, it we have to drop the fight and flight, be our authentic selves, and be loved for it, because none of us are perfect, and every single person deserves to be who they are. Wow, I've so enjoyed this conversation. I you have no idea how much I really hope that this has helped our she-worders who are listening to this show. If you had any question about whether or not you deserved better, or whether or not you've been through this experience, whether or not you're going through this experience, or whether or not you can see this experience in someone else and you just want to draw alongside and give them some advice. So my last question, and I'm going to start with you, Caroline, and I'm going to come around the table. How and where and what is the journey of recovery?
I think one needs to start by accepting that it is a journey, not just attending a session and actually expecting that everything will be okay, that you will forget the past, because the plan is not to forget, but accept. So I think when it comes to the therapeutic journey, it's an important place within an individual's soul to actually, you know, thank oneself for doing the step, for almost going against what you were taught for the fact that you are realizing that you have enough value to actually take this step. So, and nowadays, you know, you can even look at different articles, you can read different articles, you can become aware before you enter the therapeutic session. So I think it starts from the initiative and the acceptance of I am able to take the step.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to come to you, Roberta. What can you add to that?
What I can add to is, and what I'm thinking right now is so coming a bit full circle to where we started. It's not the label that matters. It's your experience, you know? So I think what matters is that if your experience was that you were not seen, you were never validated, your parents lived off your life, and all the other things that we mentioned, whether they're narcissists or not, if that is your experience, then it was not okay. Mm-hmm. And you need to find a way to help yourself understand that it was not okay and that you deserved better.
Yeah. Claire?
Believing that you can change your narrative, sort of being aware that you would have been following a certain script, and a script is a script, it can be changed, you know? So I think it's difficult to believe that you can live a different script, but it is possible. Writing your own script, let's say, together with people who offer us reparative experiences and relationships.
Ladies, thank you so much. I am quite sure that the show will have a deep, deep impact for those women who need it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.